Received in the spirit in which I'm giving this, this observation. We did the resolution last week commending all of the agencies in regards to the work they did in response to the August 20th flood. And as we did that, everybody turned to, I guess that would be the west side of the room, and acknowledged some of the city staff that were there. The people who kept us safe during this event that carried out well over a month were the engineers, streets, parks, motor equipment, or what's it called? Fleet services, traffic engineering. Those who are the ones who are really there 24/7. Oh, and IT, of course, IT. So I just want to make sure that we acknowledge that people who are not usually in the spotlight and we usually don't recognize as safety officers are the ones who carried the brunt of the work here and had to make the decisions literally hour by hour, especially after the successive rains came. So, Jojo, you're on.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jojo O'Brien. I work with City Engineering and had been preparing for high lake level flooding for the past year and a half. So I'm going to kind of give the intro to this past storm event, and then I'm going to kick it over to Janet Schmidt and Greg Fries. So today we're going to talk a little bit about flash flooding and then the flooding from high lake levels that we experienced shortly afterwards. And then we're going to talk about some lake level information, go over the damages that we experienced, talking about how engineering responded, public and private damages, and then sandbag and protective measures. Oh, thank you very much. Does that help?
Yeah.
Janet's going to go over FEMA, and Greg's going to go over how does engineering plan to proceed, what we're going to do moving forward, new policy, looking at short-term, mid-term, and types of solutions for actions that we'll be taking, and then some next steps. So this is a map showing the precipitation totals that we experienced from August 20th to August 21st of this year. The areas in green, dark green, are the areas that only had 0 to 3 inches. The lighter green is 3 to 6 inches. The yellow is 6 to 9 inches. The orange is 9 to 12 inches, and the red is 12 to 15 inches. This is information from the KMKX radar, and the professor Dan Wright at UW corrected it with some rain gauges. So as you can see, there's a few patches there that had 12 to 15 inches, and a 1% chance storm of occurring would be 6.66 inches in 24 hours. So this was a very large rain event in some localized areas, which led to significant flash flooding. So the city had a really quick response to those flood events. We had people on call overnight. The EOC was opened immediately. We surveyed damage. We did emergency repairs. And then we started segueing into the second event that is separate from the flash flooding that occurred on the west side. And that was that lake levels started slowly to come up. So the city was able to begin preparing the isthmus while triaging flash flooding on the west side. And as you can see here, the two, I don't think I have a clicker, but the two northernmost areas in purple that have the light blue lines through them, both of those areas, any drop of water that falls in there is going to end in Lake Mendota. So that's those watersheds. The lower one with the black lines going through it, that whole watershed drains to Lake Monona and Lake Wabisa. So all of the rain that fell over those areas slowly started coming towards the lakes. And as you can see in the graph on the right, that both lakes were above their target summer max values, which is pretty typical. We have generally too much water in the system to really hold the lakes to those target summer values. But we were over a foot over our target summer on Lake Monona and slightly less than a foot over our target summer max on Lake Mendota, even before all of this began. So it's hard to think about how lake levels come up and end up in the middle of the isthmus. So I'm going to flip through a series of slides that kind of shows the water coming up. Lake Monona essentially functions as a bathtub with the rest of the city and will fill up the low-lying areas. And slowly as the water comes up, you can see it spread across the city, and especially within that isthmus area. So this flooding shows significantly more flooding than what we saw in the August 20th event, in the lake level flooding thereafter. However, this shows the extent of what we thought that Lake Monona could come up to. And if you look at the middle of the isthmus and you're wondering, how can there be water there? Because the lake's not connected to it, we actually have a storm sewer infrastructure that does connect the lakes. So typically what happens is you have a lower lying area and all the water is going to pool into it unless you have a pipe pulling that water out into the lake. It's going to sit there and it's going to create its own little mini pool until it evaporates or sinks into the ground. Our storm sewer system was designed really well to convey that water from the middle of the isthmus in particular out to the Yahara River. However, when the Yahara River starts coming up, the stormwater also comes up and ends up sitting in the middle of the isthmus. So the sewers end up acting in reverse, and you end up having lake water standing across the isthmus, which on Mifflin and Ingersoll you saw almost immediately right after that August 20th storm. This also leads to an increased risk in flash flooding. So when the storm sewers are full of water, it's really hard to push more water through them. So if you have a rain event coming, your sewers aren't going to very quickly push that water through. So water is going to pool up on the isthmus, and it's going to slowly push water through and equalize with the lakes and the river. That takes a little bit of time, and that's that flash flooding that we were really worried about and that we were trying to have property owners prepare for. Luckily, the city, as I had mentioned, has been preparing for something like this to occur since the start of 2017. We did a tabletop in last fall with a bunch of different agencies within the city, and we talked about different issues that we might see if the lake level started rising, knowing that this is kind of a slow but very long-term problem that we would be experiencing, and trying to figure out and think forward as to what we might see. So from that tabletop, we started doing some further planning. We created a utility plan, identifying some of the vulnerabilities and creating contingency plans. One of the things that immediately began happening was that all of our sanitary pump stations had generators installed above what we thought our max flooding extent could be. We looked at the sanitary system and tried to figure out how that might be impacted with inflow and infiltration occurring from longstanding flooding. The fire department had an Aspire intern working on some of the public information. We did critical elevation surveys throughout the entire isthmus and throughout the city of Madison in low-lying areas that we thought would be at risk. So we had the water utility, the Monona Terrace, Metro Transit, MMSD schools, pump stations, and a variety of other locations surveyed so we would know when the floods came up to a certain level when different things would have issues. So the water utility was immediately able to turn around and start sandbagging as soon as those floodwaters came up, knowing that they had some critical infrastructure that was low-lying. And we started creating a debris management plan. So the long story of what happened with this flash flooding segueing into that slow onset lake level rise is that you can see on the top, that's the line showing Lake Mendota, and that lake elevation peaked pretty quickly, actually on August 23rd. And that's when it reached its max elevation. Lake Monona started slowly coming up and reached its max elevation on September 6th. And has started coming down, but as you can see at the very tail end, even the storms yesterday caused those lakes to come up a little bit again. Something that's not really explained in those two graphs is that across the Yahara River you have a gradient. So as the water is traveling from Lake Mendota, where it's really high, down to Lake Monona, you have higher water halfway along that river. So that caused significantly more flooding than we had anticipated there would be in the East Wash Quarter and on East Johnson Street. So the area in green at the top of the map is all areas that drain to Johnson Street. And the areas in yellow, kind of in the middle along the East Wash Quarter, all that drains near East Main and Johnson Street. So if the Ohio River is higher there than it is at the lake, you're going to have higher standing water in those areas along the isthmus. So as you can see in the map there, that dark blue area is the observed max flooding extents that we saw during this rain event. And that is 849.4 on Johnson Street, 849.2 on Main Street in East Wash, and 848.52 on Lake Monona. And then that lighter blue area that's splotchy in the middle of the isthmus shows where we were worried that that flash flooding could occur. So I want to talk a little bit about what the city can and can't do when we're faced with a situation like this, specifically with this past storm. So the city was able to go and protect critical infrastructure. We're able to do some sandbagging, make sure that the manholes for our sanitary sewer weren't having water pouring in over the top, so they were sealed with rubber and sandbags on top of those. We worked on public messaging. We worked on closing roads. We worked on making sure that once roads were closed, that cars were able to still travel in and out of the isthmus. Dane County, all the while, was doing some weed cutting to increase flow to lower the lakes and trying to manage those lakes appropriately. Unfortunately, we can't control how much water leaves Lake Monona very effectively. That outlet is set. We can't control the amount of water coming into the system. It either has to be stored in Mendota or passed down to the other lakes. We can't just stop it before it gets in. And then the county was working to protect the locks. So Lake Mendota was operated in a manner to prevent dam failure. So you could only bring up the lake to a certain elevation, and then you were at risk of having the dam fail. And with that, we also needed to think about creating enough storage for upcoming rain events. As you guys are well aware, it continued to rain from August 20th till today. And with that, we needed to make sure that we had enough space in the lake, Lake Mendota, to store that rain. So the county was releasing 1 to 3 inches a day, which allowed people to prepare for Lake Monona to slowly come up. And now Janet's going to take over and talk a little bit about how engineering responded.
So, hi everybody, I'm Janet Schmidt with Engineering Division. So, some of the stuff that Jojo was talking about is related to the damages. So, engineering, we're tallying up about 250 calls and emails to date, and thank you for folks, if you get any information from your constituents, if you forward them on to us. What we're doing is we're trying to collect as much information as we can get. So if you have contacts or you received emails, if you could send them on to us, we'd really appreciate it. So we've been very busy. We continue to get calls and emails yet today. I got some more things that we've done. As soon as the rains hit, the flash flooding, we had field staff out the next day. We're really busy trying to review all the greenways and shorelines, see what kind of damage we were anticipating. We had crews on 24/7 to help respond to these emergencies, and they worked really hard to get infrastructure back in place. As part of our efforts, we leveraged about 2,000 volunteer hours for helping sandbag, which was huge. That was a huge help. I don't think we could have done what we did without those volunteers. And then, of course, we had the National Guard come in and assist. And for some of the big sandbag installations, folks would have never been able to do that on their own. So as part of the damages, Jojo helped put together this map with information from building inspection. It's a heat map. We can share this if you guys are interested, but it gives you all the blue dots on here from small to large. It gives you a magnitude of the damages that were reported. All the red dots are businesses. All the blue dots are residential. So we had tallied to date $15.1 million of residential damage and about $2.4 million worth of business damage. So that's a total of private damage of $17.5 million. I'll talk about this a little bit later, but the public damage for the public infrastructure was a little under $4 million that we've tallied up so far. But I wanted to make sure that folks understand that there's a lot of people that we don't think have actually reported this. I've looked at a couple sites, and I've cross-checked it against the list we have, and we're noticing that this isn't even, this doesn't cover everybody. So there's probably a lot more out there that we don't even know that hasn't been reported. So I'm just going to show you some of the pictures. This is going to be both public and private damage, just to kind of show you what happened. A lot of this is going to be based off the flash flood that happened on the 20th. So for some of the public damage, here's a couple photos of some street work that we had done already. So on the far left, that's Deming Way on the far west side of town. You can see the folks standing in the hole, so you can kind of get the magnitude of what happened there. The whole street washed away. There's gas lines, utility lines that are just kind of hanging out there. We had emergency crews come out. We had contractors come out and do emergency repairs, and they got that opened up very shortly afterwards. The middle picture is over at Regent Street by Kenosha. This is a greenway crossing, and what happened is there's two big pipes there, and there's so much water that it jumped up over the pipes, and the pipes washed out, and it also took out part of the street. So we had city staff is out there taking care of that right away after that occurred. And then the one on the right is Baker Avenue. That's a street end over in Spring Harbor area. You can see, what you can't see is a little bit further off the picture is the lake. But what you can see is that the lake level was so high that it actually washed out the gravel road, and you can see the algae that remains left. That's how high the water got. Our streets division actually went out and got that taken care of right away, too. We were fairly lucky with the public infrastructure. We actually feel that it held up quite well. There was damages, but some areas got hit a little bit harder. But in general, we feel like it actually held up pretty well. So here's some drainage ways and parks that didn't fare quite as well as other places. But on the far left is Glenwood Children's Park. This is over by Glenway Golf Course. On the picture with the pipe sticking out of the ground, that's a 24-inch pipe. If you look, it's hard to tell from the photographs, but that's probably about a 5.5-foot hole that eroded away. There's enough water that basically washed the pipe out and then forced it out of the ground. We're working right now to get emergency repairs done for that. You can see the debris that was spread out throughout the park at the lower end. And then there's a picture that's kind of in the middle on the left side. It shows a storm pipe, and that's where all the debris ended up. And unfortunately, that all ends up in Lake Wingrove. On the right-hand side are some pictures of storm sewer easement that goes behind some properties over in the Wexford neighborhood. We're working with a contractor right now to get that fixed. Hard to tell the magnitude from the pictures again, but if the picture on the top and on the right-hand side, that's about a 6 to 8 foot hole. What happened is the storm sewer was inundated. There's too much water. The water jumped up over the sidewalk. It found its way through the backyards and basically washed a 900-foot gully throughout people's backyards. On the picture on the lower right-hand corner is a house. The water spread out. It actually washed all their landscaping and all their rock out from underneath the house and flooded their basement. Here's some pictures of the ponds at Odana and Westtown. I'm sure you guys have probably seen these, but on the left is Odana Golf Course. You can't recognize it because it looks like a lake. On the right-hand side is Odana Road. You can see all the stalled cars, and that's a significant amount of water. The pond is actually on the lower right-hand corner. I looked it up because I wasn't sure, but I think there's a little white thing in the middle that you can barely see. That's the top of the soccer goal, and that's probably about 8 feet off the ground. So you can understand how deep that water was. These are some pictures of some cleanup work that we were faced to do over on Junction Road on the far west side. On the left-hand set of pictures is the greenway over by Attic Angels. That had significant damage. It washed out a whole bunch of debris into the street. We had to have our streets crews come and clean it up. We're working on estimates to have that repaired soon. On the right-hand side, you can see the sandbags. That's Monona Terrace. You can see like the before where the person's walking, that's actually the bike path. And you can see the grass out there, how far it's actually flooded up before our crews came and put some sandbags and pumps in place. As far as private damages, the west side and the near west side got hit really hard. And some of the folks over in Wexford, Walnut Grove, and Sauk Creek really saw some significant damage. So here's a couple pictures. over at Wexford Village, the picture on the far left is a bunch of cars. So between this intersection and next intersection, there's probably about 20 dead cars basically stalled out in high water. Total in that whole neighborhood, I'd guess about 50 or 60 stalled cars in that area. The picture in the middle on the right hand on the top, that shows the water level. You can see the red line. This is a house that got significant damage. The water was probably about 18 inches up on their house. Their whole lower level inundated, and you can see the garbage on the curb from what was left of their lower level having to remove all the debris. The far left bottom is a picture, if anybody's familiar with Menards West and Brennan's over there. If you're looking at the picture on the right-hand side, you'd be staring down the street from Menards. Menards would be on the right-hand side. This is how high the water got in that area. It's just it's shocking how deep that was and how many folks had problems over there. Here's a couple pictures of the debris. This doesn't even come close to documenting everything that happened, but pictures on Odana Road of all the garbage from all the shops that were damaged. We also have some individual property owners had damage. The picture on the far right was folks over at Park Edge, Park Ridge. They're just basically opening up their windows and stripping out their basements and throwing it out the windows. Here's a couple more pictures of the private damage. These are over by Borner Park. They were hit pretty hard. A couple folks had their whole basements basically filled with water. You could see from the debris and that's left on the curb. The pictures on the far right show an area over by Gettle Avenue. The blue house, if you look at it, you notice that there's some concrete blocks that are missing. If you look at the picture on the bottom, that's what's left. The whole wall caved in. All the debris came in and filled up their basement with dirt. The picture on the very top far right is basically the water and junk floating up in their basement, and you can see it's two steps away from their first floor. And this is an example of one that we don't think reported, but we know it's a significant issue, is the group health over at Sauk Trails. I tried to look them up on our list, and I didn't see them on there. The Sauk Trails Business Park had a lot of issues here, but this one in particular is still closed as of last week. It's still closed now? Yep, I figured. So the picture on the far right, the big picture with the arrows on, that's a nice, bright, sunny day. I took that off of Google Maps. The arrows indicate the water level of how high that water got in the greenway. So if you compare them to the two pictures on the left, there's garbage hung up on that metal railing. That's how high the water got. And then there's a picture of a tree, and you're wondering, what's that tree showing me? But if you look, there's weeds and grass in that tree. And you can see that was almost 6 feet off the ground at that point. And those arrows indicate where those two things were taken. So that's you know, if that parking lot was full of cars, you can just imagine how much damage that would have caused. And then, of course, you know, after the flash flooding, then we had all the issues with the isthmus flooding. So these are a couple of pictures. On the left side is Main Street with the high water. This was several days after the flooding. Water was sitting there for a long time over by Northern Court before it finally receded. Then we have a picture of Johnson Street over by Forest Street. You can see how high the water was there. And then, of course, Tenney Park. We got an aerial picture of that, and the whole park is basically underwater. So, as JoJo was mentioning, after the flash flooding, all the lake's levels were rising, the isthmus was starting to flood, so we had to basically jump into action with sandbagging efforts. So staff was on you know, basically 24/7 working around the clock along with volunteers and the National Guard. We had about 225,000 sandbags that we provided. The city staff, again, worked 13 days, 24/7, to try and get these in place and helping with volunteer efforts and directing folks, making the sandbags. We had the National Guard deployed, and we estimate about $900,000 plus worth of just protective measures, which is the sandbagging. And then, of course, now we have to get into, we have all these sandbags out there. Now what do we do? And you're going to start probably getting requests from your constituents on that as well. The map over here kind of shows you areas where we had to concentrate our efforts with the sandbagging. And here's just a couple more pictures. So, some of these locations, they might not look that impressive, but the pictures on the left, between the two, the top left, there's two houses that we sandbagged, and we figure that there's probably about 3,000 sandbags we delivered alone just to two houses. But the bottom left, we sandbagged, I think, 12 residences along the Park Edge, Park Ridge area. And those sandbags are piled, maybe like five feet wide by 3 feet tall. It's a monumental task getting them there. Then we, here's just a couple pictures of downtown on the isthmus and our sandbags along the bike path. So we do have a removal plan that the Streets Division is actually working on along with Engineering and the Parks Division. What we're hoping is that the Mayor's Office and the PIO and IT can help prepare some messages to the residents on, we've been getting the calls, like, what are we supposed to do with all these sandbags? How do we get these out of here? We need help. So we're hoping we can get a message sent out to folks to let them know what to do. There's going to be a three-week curbside collection window.
Excuse me just one second. There's about four of us have got to go to Finance Committee right now. Hopefully we'll be back in 5 minutes. Alderman Carter, you should probably take over for a moment.
All right. So I'll try to finish this up here quick. So we're going to have a three-week curbside collection, and then we're going to try and set up email and phone lines for people to call in. As far as the FEMA goes, so most of you know that we've been working with FEMA. We've provided them documentation of all the damages that occurred. We've been working with the city, county, Wisconsin Emergency Management, DNR, and we did some site visits for both the public infrastructure damage and the private infrastructure damage, including visiting homes on the west side. So FEMA, the next steps in that is FEMA has to make a determination if they're going to do the disaster declaration, and we don't expect to hear that back until early November. So once we hear more, we'll be able to know what our next steps with that is. If they do provide us funding, there's going to be another big push to get more documentation and complete what their requirements are to actually get that funding. So there's still quite a bit more to do on that. So as far as the breakdown, we had different categories for the funding request. And the bottom line is we were asking for $3.9 million of funding. So some of that is for debris removal, protective measures, which include sandbags, our roadway construction repairs, our storm sewer and drainage systems. We had some damages to our Green Tree landfill, and some buses had received some damage. We had utility damage, and then one of the big ticket items is still kind of a question mark for us, was the shorelines, and that's the park and rec part of that, because until the water recedes, we don't really know what damage really occurred to the shorelines. And with that, I will pass it off to Greg.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Greg Fries from City Engineering. So now you've kind of seen how we were preparing, what happened, what we've done to date. But I think Janet referenced we have like 250 calls and more that didn't call. And so the question really becomes, how does engineering proceed from this? So from our perspective, with all these different calls, we have to proceed in a uniform and a predictable way. So we've drafted up two policies. Actually, one is new and one is a revised policy. The new policy is how we'll respond to public flooding concerns. And the other one is a revised policy of how we will deal with private. And I'll describe those here. Public problems are basically really where water that is in the right-of-way or a greenway leaves that public space and enters private property and causes damage. Now, we have lots of cases where Streets will flood onto private property and don't cause damage. And that's, from our perspective, during especially during an event like the magnitude we experienced, that's going to happen, and I can't really prevent that. But what I really want to try to prevent is water leaving public space and entering private property and causing damage. The private problem is where water is running from one private property to another, or sometimes, you know, across five or six, and it gets to that last one and enters someone's property, and we get called to help them. That I'm not going to focus on that tonight because we have limited time, but that policy has been around for a while, although we are revisiting it as part of this because it was last revisited, I think, in 2008. So the public problems that I'm going to focus on today, there's really two types, and both Janet and JoJo have talked about these things, right? We have the flash flood that we had on the west side, and then we have isthmus and surrounding areas that are flooding largely due to backwater. So just to put this in perspective for you, JoJo made this map. This is an old soil map overlaid with the City of Madison boundaries. So for the isthmus problems, everything you see in blue up there is a hydric soil. So what does that really mean in real terms? Essentially, those are all wetlands that we built on at one point. So if you look at that big swath through the middle of the isthmus and along Starkweather Creek, and you see all the urban infrastructure over that, that is all essentially made land. Okay, we filled that. It's not we personally, anybody in this room, but you know, it was filled at one point. And the problem for us really, and I've said this many times, is the decision to fill it wasn't mine. The decision that I really object to is that they didn't fill it enough. Okay, they needed to keep going another couple feet, and they did not do that. And so in the isthmus, that's what we're dealing with. So this is a little history. Flash flooding, and I won't go into all of this, but part of what we have for why we have problems with flash flooding is largely because public standards for how we design have varied dramatically over time. And it probably might surprise some of you to know that there was no ordinance to require stormwater detention until 1983. Okay? Now, if that shocks you, there was no state regulation on stormwater until 2004, okay? So you say 1983 was really late, okay? It was still essentially 20 years ahead of the state, okay? So that's it from a detention standpoint. We also, you know, have how do we size pipes? That system has varied dramatically over the years too. I mean, I've looked at old scrolls for, you know, the older areas from the 30s, 40s, 50s. There were no size pipes on the plans. They only sized mainline pipes and left all the rest of the sizing to the people who did designs out in the field. They would size them as they went. Those designs iterated as you went through time, but then you combine that with the fact that there are essentially now, for say a site design, somebody's doing a site design for a new apartment complex. Okay, they have to follow Department of Professionals. What is that called? It used to be Department of Commerce. I can never remember the acronym now. They have to follow those standards. Department of Commerce has standards on how big to make your pipes coming down off your roof, but they have no standards on how to set your parking garage. Is it high enough? How do I have to drain that? We have some that we try and hold developers to, but those standards are largely individual by whoever is doing the plan and what both the builder and developer and the engineer or landscape architect are willing to accept. So as you combine, you know, varying public standards with individual standards for private development, you can run into problems. So moving forward, how do we move forward? So the first thing I want to touch on, and I met with Alder Fair here earlier tonight, and a lot of these problems that we were really highlighted on the west side during this event. We have to be very careful as we move forward as engineers, okay? We have some very, very long drainage systems on the west side. Janet mentioned Sauk Creek. in Older Fairs District, that we have some that drain to the Badger Mill Creek and eventually to Nesbitt Road. They are miles long, okay? And so fixing one particular problem, okay, while it might be pretty easy to do, what we have to remember is if we're storing water, whether in a place we intend to or not, if we're storing that water, we're slowing it down. And so it's called unintended detention, okay? So you're slowing that water down. If I fix the pipes, that water goes somewhere, right? And where it goes is to the next pipe crossing. So I can fix one person, or at least it's potentially possible, that I can fix one person's problem at the expense of another. So if I'm trying to protect my private property, there's some law and case history about that. But from a public perspective, I have to be very careful that I don't negatively impact someone else to benefit another person. So I can't move that problem. I have to look at these systems as a whole, and that's a complicated hydraulic and hydrologic model in some cases that I have to do. I just want to touch on this. Janet did as it turns out, a lot of these things are kind of in place. One of the things we had to do for the budget last year was we had to do an RESJ review. What we chose to do was for flooding. So we had that done. Janet had that submitted, I think, like a month or two before this actually occurred. So we do have a plan for how we want to engage people a little bit more, and we want to get some additional impact, I think, or additional input. As Janet mentioned, one of the things we don't have is probably all the complaints, right? So we probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of half. As we go forward, though, here's how we kind of have reacted to date. I have them under here as short-term actions. We've done a lot of this, although it is ongoing. We've done data collection. We did some immediate response. We've done those A, B, and C things. What we are working on now, really, is we're down to D and E. So we are trying to continue to collect data and triage these things and decide where they fit, right? Are they a public problem, a private problem? We haven't started to triage, you'll see the next part, the public, once we break them into public-private, now we have to triage even further. And the midterm action here, so we have to prioritize, we're talking about the public projects today, so we have to find a way. We have a lot of problems here that were reported, and we have to find a way. We have to prioritize staff time. We also have to prioritize budgets here. So I highlighted the important part. This is a draft policy, so don't think there's not opportunity to change this yet. But this is what we have written to date, okay? So we're gonna give priority to projects with higher multipliers of benefits. What does that mean? It's just a cost-benefit ratio. So we have to look at the value of what was damaged, the cost to do something for it, and the higher that multiplier is, right, the more good we do per dollar, I'll call it, that gets a higher priority. Now, these are kind of ranked, but we're not giving these points. This is just ranked higher versus ranked lower. This is a first time for this policy, so we don't want to assign a number to these things yet because I don't feel confident that we would get that number right. So second is priority we've given to projects that have a positive impact on emergency response routes. So the obvious example might be McKenna Boulevard in Alder McKinney's district. That is right. It's a major response route. We have both a fire and a police station half a mile or so away from that. So if we can't get cars across that road, that causes a real response problem for our emergency services. The other question is this the damage we're reporting only a result of August 20th, or is this a repeated damage? So August 20th, as everybody has said here, was a dramatic event, okay, essentially statistically off the chart, okay? If you got damaged during that event, I'd like to help you, and I will try to help you so this doesn't happen again. But no one that we are aware of, there is one exception, that designs for, say, a 1,000-year event. The Army Corps of Engineers does that type of stuff with shoreline protection, with protection for, like, the Mississippi diversion structure, that type of thing. They do that because the cost of failure is so dramatically high. But most agencies do not do that. So basically priority is given to repeat offenders here. If you flooded multiple times before, then you're being flooded in something and a smaller recurrence interval event, a more frequent recurrence interval, we want to try and help you. Can the problem be resolved independently? So if we look at this and there isn't this problem of moving the problem downstream where suddenly to fix your problem I have to fix six more, can I fix yours without negatively impacting other people? If the answer is yes, that rises a little bit higher to the top. Can we solve problems that are not the direct action, a result of your own action? We have some of these problems where people may have cut in a exposure purposely, and you know, as a result, they want to have a basement exposure. They're on a back. They cut in exposure. They don't get a building permit, and the greenway goes into their backyard. I'd like to help you, but this is kind of self-inflicted. You know, the answer to this is maybe to undo what you did, you know, without knowing it was something you didn't do or you shouldn't have done. Proximity of the project to projects we already have planned. So some obvious examples of this are, we have a project plan for University Avenue. I think it's in 2021. There's an obvious flooding problem. As long as I've been here on University Avenue, we have piecemealed that over the years since about 2003. We have an oncoming project in 2021. We'll try and do improvements with that project because it's already scheduled. And finally, priority will be given to areas that are within an NRT neighborhood. Okay, so then this is just kind of what are we going to look at when we start looking at problems. So can we do this with just a simple pipe upgrade? Can we look at changing the overflow structure? Can we look at going upstream and creating intended detention to slow the water down and reduce a flooding problem that might be downstream? Is there a solution on private property that might be small? So my bad example might be, could that person who put in a window close it back up if that was done recently? And then the last one is there a major change on private property? So we've toyed with the idea in some cases, most recently in Alder McKinney's district, you back up to a greenway and I may not be able to protect you, because when the house was built in the late 70s, early 80s, they allowed an exposure roughly 2.5 feet above the channel elevation here. I may not be able to protect you. If I can't, can we look at buying an easement and paying you a cost to cure to close off your lower exposure and put dirt up against your foundation so you lose living space, but we have an easement to flow water there and your home no longer floods? So that's an option that we are considering. So That's kind of where the policy is. The policy is longer than that, but we don't have enough time to go through it. I'll be happy to send it to anybody who requests it. In terms of our next steps, we would go eventually to the Board of Public Works. The private drainage policy that I mentioned has been approved by the Board of Public Works twice prior, I think, and so this would be a third amendment to that policy. We are going to have some ongoing meetings with Alders about projects in their districts. We are restructuring some staff in the sewer section to create a flood control and pond greenway group so we can coordinate these efforts better. And we are looking at doing these large watershed studies in priority locations and then follow that up with public informational meetings and public engagement, and we're working with IT to create a website where people could sign up. There's so many problems. I can't contact all these people individually and talk to them for a half hour, so I have to find a way where they can sign up and I can get them information in a more routine manner, so we are working with IT on that. And I think we are at questions.
Okay. I bet you there's more than one. Alderman Bedarcila.
Thank you so much for all your work. So my question is about, Greg, is about working with the municipalities, villages that are right kind of around us. So for me, clearly Shorewood, Village of Shorewood Hills, but you know, some of this flooding were really right where we have, like, Middleton was affected. So is there, like, a group that is of engineers or of you folks that are getting together because of what you were talking about, the downstream, upstream, like how it's affecting?
Yeah, so we have, we've already reached out to Middleton. So on the far west side through the Sauk, Old Sauk Trails Park through the Wexford Village, Sauk Heights, that whole neighborhood, whole area. If you saw the photos, that drains into Pheasant Branch Creek in Middleton. And if you saw the things around Costco and all that kind of stuff, right, that's all where all this water goes. And it washed out, you know, huge swaths of their Pheasant Branch Creek Conservancy. We have reached out to them already to set up a meeting with their engineering staff, because in that particular case, even if I fix all my problems, I actually give it to Middleton, right, which might not be the nicest thing I could do. So we do have to be cognizant of that as well. And in the University Avenue case, there was a plan way back in 2003 that is probably going to be revisited here. I didn't bring a slide of that, but we are that's actually at the PWI meeting this Thursday, Mr. Mayor. But we are looking at there was a tunnel proposed from basically the intersection of University and Midvale, kind of diagonally across the Blackhawk Golf Course and underneath it, to create a new discharge point to the lake. And back in 2003, Shorewood had objected to that plan. But the recent events are causing some rethink of that. So we're gonna meet with them and talk about that as a possibility.
And Nick Zavos is contacting these municipalities, and we're going to try and get all the mayors and chairs together to discuss a common strategy. Any other questions? There's no other questions. I've got a couple. Let's take something like the very large pond that is in the center of the Blackhawk subdivision, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of damage there.
Yep.
When you get something that massive with that kind of a detention basin, or the one that we've got between Odana and Mineral Point across from Memorial High School, mm-hmm. where the soccer fields are, from an engineering standpoint, what's possible where you've got a limited geographic area and you can only go down so deep?
So both of those, so to my knowledge, the Mineral Point Pond and Blackhawk both have had quite large events in the past and have never reacted that way, right? They were never designed for that storm event. So, I mean, we're gonna reanalyze both of those. There, in the Blackhawks case, there is a possibility that you could. So that actually, both of these, the key feature about both of these is they are both, again, enclosed depressions. The large pond in Blackhawk actually has a high point in a street. It used to be a kettle depression back before that was developed, and there were extremely tight regulations on developing that as a result. And it's possible that you could burst that pipe, the release structure from there, because it's quite deep, and expand its capacity. But it would have, as it goes to the Pheasant Branch, it would have that impact of adding more water to the Pheasant Branch system that already flooded downstream. So I've already talked to two of the residents in Blackhawk. They did not flood by a lot, meaning they still flooded. There was dramatic damage, right? Because once the water gets into your basement, it doesn't matter if it was an inch or whether it was 4 inches. It largely, you know, you have a lot of damage. So for them, it was not a ton of depth as opposed to some of the other problems I've heard. So it might be possible for them to actually do some work on their property to provide a higher level of protection. For Odana Mineral Point, that system had problems all the way to Spring Harbor, which is where that goes. That drains down eventually to Bordner at Rosa Road, and that whole system was beyond capacity. I don't want to venture many guesses, but I think that pond is going to largely remain the way it is because the system downstream is extremely limited in terms of its ability to upsize without extremely large public works projects.
Let me ask one more question. I don't know if you touched on this while Finance Committee was meeting, and I know you can't speak for the county, but did you give us or can you give us any kind of an indication what the county is doing, particularly in regards to the lake levels?
The last I heard from Dane County, they had a resolution introduced last week, I believe, to the Board of Supervisors. It was being referred out to a few committees, and it was I should back up a step. For those of you who don't know, there have been at least two prior in my tenure, looks at the lakes and how they are managed. They call them Yahara Lakes Advisory Group 1 and 2, one in 2003 and one in 2000 and then one in 2008. And they both resulted in what I would call a bureaucratic stalemate in that everyone agreed that we didn't like any new ideas, we don't like what we're doing now, but we don't like what we're doing now slightly more than what everybody else proposed, right? So we stayed with the status quo. The county is not proposing to go through that exercise again. They are proposing to bring together a group of technical professionals who would look at this only from a flood control perspective and a management of the lake perspective.
And that's consistent with our position.
I am a fan, and so, yes.
Okay. Alderwoman Rummel?
Thank you, Mayor. That was kind of one of my questions. Because the two things I hear a lot about, one is how are we going to change management of the lake? And I often say that's a bigger question than what the city can do. But what is the city's role in that? We kind of know what the county's starting to make steps. Do we have any role other than just to share our opinion?
The county is charged with the management of the lakes by DNR order, so we can only provide guidance or opinion. I think we could petition the DNR on our own if we chose to do that, and make an argument for whatever particular management strategy we wanted to do. But I think at this point it makes more sense to attempt to work with the county.
And my second question is, and we heard this, especially the first few days after the when the river got really high, is like, what if the dam overflows? And we were reassured that the county is taking care of the dam, and it wasn't really in jeopardy. But what happens if it's in jeopardy? It is real. Do we have a plan to evacuate or manage that situation?
As a result of this exercise, which I would call a live exercise, the fire police did create a plan, although they did not share that with me. I don't know if I would call it an evacuation plan, but I would call it an emergency response plan that they did create and were ready to implement if that were necessary.
Okay, thanks. I'm sure we'll have more questions.
Alderwoman Zellers.
Similar questions. You've answered some of the questions that I have. But we all know that the lake level, Mendota, was about a foot higher than its supposed maximum. Is it possible to keep it below that maximum and even at the minimum? And what would need to be done in order to do that? Because that would solve a lot of the problems.
You can keep Mendota, if you choose, within its operating range. That has repercussions for Monona. If they had chosen, JoJo said Monona or Mendota was a foot above. Was it a foot above?
Foot.
1.4.
And Monona was like 10 inches, I think, above. So if they had chosen earlier in the summer to drop Mendota, and keep it within its operating range, that would have very likely caused Monona to start, rather than 10 inches higher, maybe a foot and a half higher, right?
Presumably there are ways to get that water out. Is it possible realistically to manage this? Because obviously we don't want to flood people because of Monona's rise, but that does have a drainage point too. So,
right. So I think this is part of where that technical committee is going to go. The county spent a lot of effort right after the event to increase discharge out of Monona by weed cutting and removing restrictions with equipment on their barges. And they were largely successful. I can't remember the exact numbers, but they did increase discharge out of Lake Monona dramatically.
And so why wasn't that done earlier in order to bring Mendota down without endangering Monona?
That's a question I can't answer for you.
That's a question for the people in county government who manage the lake levels. But I just want to expand on this. There are two significant barriers to, in effect, draining Lake Monona and the waters to the south. One is the dam in Stoughton, and the other is the rail trestle across the northern portion of Upper Mud Lake, right below where we go across the Beltline, and you can see Mud Lake to the south there. Those two will need engineering resolutions, that rail trestle and the decision about what to do with the dam in Stoughton. Meantime, the most significant thing that could be done is to vigilantly remove the weeds from the choke point in Monona Bay in the southern part of Lake Monona so that as much water can be released from Lake Mendota as possible without flooding properties along Lake Monona. And that we are communicating to those in charge of lake management levels at the county is what we expect as the immediate result of what's happened here. It is 6:29. Alderwoman Carter, Martin, and Rummel again in the queue. We really got to start the council meeting. It's 6:28, so let's at least Alderman Carter.
Yeah, mine's really quick. Did you mention the effect of the 20th and forward on Winger Creek?
Winger Creek.
Part of the E-way?
So Winger Creek, you know, very shortly after the event occurred, within a week, became a backwater of Lake Monona. It was essentially at the same elevation, and Lake Winger, for that matter, was essentially at the same elevation as Lake Monona. So you know, there are some areas along Winger Creek that were having drainage difficulties, although not a ton. There were some areas in the town of Madison that were affected because they drained to the Arboretum, and Lake Winger was obviously very high. But Winger Creek largely operated reasonably well during this. So,